first chapter of Genesis and have come at last through the succession of creative days to the seventh day. This is a most remarkable day. It's what is called commonly the Sabbath day. Some time ago I visited with a neighbor whose son was having his bar mitzvah, a Jewish family whose 13-year-old boy was coming into his manhood, and I was very impressed by the ceremonies that connected with it, as this young boy, for the first time in public, read from the Torah, the scrolls of the Hebrew Scriptures, and he gave thanks for two things. One was the law, and the other was the Sabbath. And here we're looking now at the meaning and significance of this remarkable Sabbath day, one of the oldest institutions in the world. I find that many people today are troubled about the question, should we observe the Sabbath day today? Should we keep the seventh day as holy unto God, as the fourth commandment tells us? Or are we free to worship and serve God and attend services and so on Sunday? And many are confused at this point. Now, we want to try to clarify some of the issues on this today and come to some answers to that question. I want to try to set forth, as we look at this account together, seven remarkable facts that I think will open to us the truth that's hidden in this strange institution, the Sabbath day. Let's get the account before us. Chapter 2. Thus the heavens and the earth were finished, and the host of them. And on the seventh day God finished his work which he had done, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had done. So God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it, because on it God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. Perhaps the most striking thing about that, if you've been following through on all the other days of creation, is the absence, the total absence of the phrase that has been on every other day. There was an evening and there was a morning, so-and-so number day. Now, you don't have that here. There's a total absence of this phrase about the evening and the morning. This confirms, I think, and suggests strongly what we've tried to stress throughout this account, that this creative week does not stress time. Time is not the factor. There's no development here, as the evening and the morning suggests, at all. In fact, twice in this account you have the word finished here. God finished his work. The heavens and the earth were finished, and therefore there's no further development needed. It's all through. God has rested. Now that brings us to the second great fact about this, and that is that the supreme meaning of this word Sabbath is rest. Actually, the word has three meanings in Hebrew. There's the word Sabbat, which is the Hebrew form, means, of course, Sabbath by alliteration, that is, by literal interpretation. It also has the meaning of rest. The Sabbat was the rest day, and by derivation, because of its place in the creative week, it also means seven. It's the Hebrew word for seven. So it means Sabbath, rest, and seven. Now, the basic word is rest. And what kind of a rest is in view here? We're told clearly that God rested on the seventh day. Why? Well, not because he was tired. This kind of rest that's meant here and connected with the Sabbath is not in order to restore strength. That's what we rest for. We get weary and tired. Our bodies are worn. Our minds are exhausted and fatigued. And so we find it necessary to rest in order that we might restore strength to our physical being. It's absurd, of course, to think of God as needing rest of that type. And it's absurd, therefore, to read that kind of rest into this. That isn't what he's talking about. The rest that is in view here is that of the cessation of a specific effort. It's not because God was tired. He was simply through, that's all. When I lived in Hawaii for a while, I found that the Polynesians have a very expressive phrase or word for this, for being through with something. They call it pau, P-A-U. And a Hawaiian, when he finishes his work, he may be very energetic yet, but he says, I'm pau. That is not, I'm tired, I'm through. And God rested because he was through. And that's the specific meaning of this word, the ending of a specific effort. Now, what is that effort from which God ceased or rested? The third great fact about this account is that the rest which God entered into was from creation. It says so. God rested from all his work which he had done in creation. Now, it certainly doesn't mean that God has remained inactive all the days since that have come in the course of history from the time when he ended his work in creation. For God is not inactive in human affairs. On one occasion, you remember, Jesus said to the Pharisees, My Father has worked hitherto, and I also work. So that in other ways, God is ceaselessly active in his work. He sustains creation by his word. He intervenes in the progress of human affairs. He brings about certain forces and certain trends and movements in history. He raises men up and puts others down. He's ceaselessly and constantly active. It would be quite wrong for us to get the idea, as some of the deists did in the beginning of our country, that God has simply created the world and then gone off and left it run its own course. That's not what it means. But he has stopped the work of creation. And there's no creative effort since the days recorded here. It's interesting that even evolutionists agree with this. Evolutionists say man is the end of the evolutionary ladder. Nothing has come beyond or since man was created. And there seems to be no apparent movement at all into a new kind of being, such as evolution would tell us, ought to be expected. But man remains throughout the thousands of years, and now some scientists are saying millions of years of his history. There's no evidence of anything beyond that. And this, with this, the Bible fully agrees. Now then, the fourth thing to note about this is that the weekly Sabbath, that is Saturday, the seventh day of the week, is not the real Sabbath, but a picture or a reminder of the real Sabbath. The real Sabbath, as we've already seen, is the ending of a specific effort on God's part, his creative effort. The weekly Sabbath is designed to remind us of that ending, of that rest that God has entered into. Therefore, we have the week. It's been part of man's history from the very beginning. Begins on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and then we start over again. And Saturday is the seventh day. It always has been and always will be. There needn't be any argument about that. I know some people are confused today and think that in some way, the Sabbath has been changed from Saturday to Sunday. A while ago, this was a very popular teaching among Christians. And even Sunday was called the Sabbath day. Once in a while, yet today, you hear somebody refer to the Sunday as the Sabbath day. Now, this is not true. Sunday was never the Sabbath day. The Sabbath day in the week was always Saturday, which was a picture of the rest into which God entered, which is always the true Sabbath. Now we learn from the New Testament that that weekly Sabbath day, coming at the end of the week, is also a picture, or it's called there a shadow, of Christ. It's a picture of the one who's coming, which is Jesus Christ. You find the Apostle Paul teaching this very clearly in his letter to the Colossians, in which he uses this very term about the Sabbath, calling it a shadow. If I may just turn to that passage quickly here. In chapter 2, verse 13 through 17, the apostle says, "And you who were dead in trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven us all our trespasses, having canceled the bond which stood against us, that is the law, with its legal demands. This he set aside, nailing it to the cross. He disarmed the principalities and powers and made a public example of them, triumphing over them in it," that is in the cross. "Therefore," he said, "therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food or drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These are only a shadow of what is to come. But the substance," he says, "belongs to Christ." Now, when you have a shadow, it indicates that you have not yet arrived at the actual being or substance that produces the shadow. Your shadow is not you. You walk down the sidewalk and your shadow precedes you if the sun's at your back. And somebody seeing the shadow might even possibly recognize you. But it isn't you, it's just a picture of you. When I served in the United States Navy back in World War II, I was writing at that time to a very lovely girl who later became my wife. We had only met on one or two occasions before then, and all I had to remember her by was a picture, beautiful picture. It sat right on my desk. I looked at it frequently. I showed it to all my friends. It was a very important and precious picture to me because it's all I had to remind me of my wife. But the other day I was going through the garage and I ran into that picture. I haven't seen it for years. It's just stuck away in a trunk. I wouldn't want to lose it or destroy it, but I don't use it very much anymore. Why? Well, because I have my wife. I have the real thing. When the real thing comes, the shadow is done away with. And so when the weekly Sabbath brought man at last with its reminder of a rest which God intended man to enter into, brought them at last to the person of Jesus Christ, God through his apostles says that Sabbath ended. The shadow passed away. And this is why Christians need clearly to understand that the shadow Sabbath ended at the cross. The next day is the day of resurrection. And on that day, our Lord Jesus rose from the dead the first day of the week, which is a symbol of the new beginning, the new start again. And that's why Sunday, the first day of the week, has become the day on which Christians worship. Now, it isn't a Sabbath day, and all the distinctions and restrictions of the Sabbath must not be put upon Sunday. It's absolutely wrong to do so. Many people are misled in this. I know that even such a great leader as D.L. Moody was brought up on the idea that Sunday had somehow become the Sabbath. For there are some groups that teach that the Pope, way back in the 3rd or 4th century, actually changed by papal edict the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. Now, that's historically unfounded. It is not true. The Pope simply recognized that Christians had for centuries already been worshiping and serving God on Sunday, the first day of the week, and he simply added to that day some of the restrictions of the Sabbath, the legal restrictions of the Jewish Sabbath. But he didn't change the day nor call Sunday the Sabbath. And yet many have done that ever since. D.L. Moody used to refuse to travel on Sunday because he thought he was violating the Sabbath. This marks a failure to understand what the Scriptures clearly teach, that shadow Sabbath ended at the cross. It has never had any fulfillment or meaning in the eyes of God since Christ came, because he is the end of the shadow. Now, the next thing, the fifth thing we want to note about this, very important, is that though the shadow Sabbath, the weekly Saturday, passed away at the cross, ended at the cross because it brought us to the object for which it was intended and given in the first place, the true Sabbath, that which comes from the very beginning of creation, the true Sabbath, the rest of God, continued and still continues today. That's why in Hebrews, the fourth chapter, the writer of this amazing letter to the Hebrews says there still remains a Sabbath for the people of God. But it's not the shadow Sabbath. It's not the day of the week that you set aside and observe because you think that this is what God has required. But it's the true Sabbath, which isn't a day at all, but a rest, a ceasing from a specific effort. And all through that chapter, in chapter 3 and 4 of Hebrew, we're taught, we're being led up to that great statement that's found in Hebrews 9 and 10, or 9 and 10 of chapter 4. So then, there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. It wasn't, as the writer has said already, it wasn't the land of Canaan into which Israel entered. If Joshua could have given them rest, he said, then God wouldn't have spoken later of another day. So it wasn't that, although that was a picture of the rest. It wasn't even the creation itself was not the rest. It was what God did on that day that was the rest. And so there remains a Sabbath rest for the people of God. And then we have it defined most clearly for us in verse 10. So then, whoever enters God's rest also ceases from his own labors, as God did from his. That's what the Sabbath is all about. The true Sabbath is to stop working as though it all depended on you. That's what God wants us to learn in this. To cease from your own works. Now that, of course, does not mean that you become a blob on the landscape, doing nothing, just sitting around, waiting for God to work. God has announced that he will work through our humanity, but he will do it while we are working. What he promises is that he will come in and fulfill our humanity with his perfecting deity. And that what we do in terms of thinking and doing and performing and working simple tasks will accomplish results far above our natural ability to accomplish. This is taught in both the Old and the New Testament. In the Old Testament, you have that remarkable word in the Psalms. Except the Lord build the house, the laborers labor in vain, he says. That is, they're working, they're building, they're active, but unless the Lord is in it, and they are resting upon the fact that God has promised to work, the whole thing is in vain. Except the Lord guard the city, the watchman watches in vain, it says. And you know how this is taught clearly in the New Testament. Jesus said, it's the Father who dwells in me. He does the works. It's not I, he said. I'm working, but it's not I who's accomplishing. It's the Father who dwells in me. I expect him to do it. I rest on the work of another. This is the great principle Paul teaches. I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live. Yet not I, but Christ lives in me. In the life I now live, I live by faith. By resting on the work of another. By faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. In Colossians 1, he speaks of the task, the ministry that's before him. He says, for this I toil, striving with all the energy which he mightily inspires within me. God at work in me. Philippians 2:13, same thing. Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, for it is God who works in you, both to will and to do of his good pleasure. Now, that's the Sabbath. And that's why this this theme of the Sabbath is so intensive in the Scriptures. It's everywhere. God is concerned about the Sabbath. Men have noted this, and they've misunderstood it and identified it with the weekly Sabbath and thought that that was what God was interested in. But God's never been interested in a ritual or a rite or a religious performance. What he wants is an attitude of the heart. That's what the Sabbath teaches. That the only labor that will ever produce anything of benefit is that which comes from an attitude that rests upon God to do the work. That does effort, but expects God to produce results. Now that's the sixth great thing that this passage teaches us. It says here that this true Sabbath, the rest of God, God blessed and hallowed it. Blessing, as we've already seen, is previously connected with fruitfulness and dominion. And what God is saying is that when we learn how to rest on God at work in us, it will produce fruitfulness and dominion. It's blessed. It has God's blessing upon it. That's why the New Testament says, without faith, it's impossible to please God. If we're not expecting God to be at work, we have no faith. And if we have no faith, we cannot please God no matter how hard we work, how dedicated, how sincere our efforts may be. They're totally fruitless and useless. God blessed the Sabbath, and furthermore, he hallowed it. Now, the word hallowed is, again, a word we don't understand very much. It really basically means to put to the proper use. It's the exact equivalent of the New Testament word to sanctify, to put to the use for which a thing was intended. I'm hallowing this microphone right now by using it for the reason it was made. I'm hallowing this Bible by reading it, hallowing the stand that's holding it. You hallow the chair on which you sit because you're using it for the purpose for which it was intended. I hallow my comb when I comb my hair, or I hallow the sink when I wash my hands. That's what it was all about. And what this is saying is that the true Sabbath, this rest upon the work of another, is the source, therefore, of blessing and fruitfulness, and is the reason for which God brought it into being. Now, God's provision for living adequately, then, is to live out of rest. That's why Jesus said, "Come unto me, all you that are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." There's an immediate sense of someone else working in my life when you come to Christ. But then he goes on, something deeper must be learned. "Take my yoke upon you," he said, "and learn of me." Learn what about me? "Well, I'm meek," he says, "and lowly and gentle of heart. And you will find rest unto your soul." And when you come to that state of humility, lowliness and meekness, where you don't expect anything to be produced by you, even though you work sincerely and diligently and loyally, you know that the secret of success, the secret of accomplishment, is not you, but God at work in you. You're resting upon that. Now, that's what I love to call the secret of human adequacy. It's also the reason why a life can become panic-proof. Are you panic-proof? Jesus was. Nobody could ever take him by surprise. Nobody could ever upset him or get him off balance because he was resting. He was laboring out of a sense that the Father was at work in him. He was capable of handling whatever came, and therefore whatever came, Jesus simply approached and did the thing that it seemed to demand with the confidence that the Father working through him would work it all out. He was adequate for it. And this is certainly what's intended in our lives. Jesus said, "As the Father has sent me, so send I you." Send us out to be confident and capable because we're not resting on us but on him. And he's perfectly confident and capable in himself. I just think this is so important that we need to spend a lot of time thinking about the emphasis that the Scripture gives us on the principle of the Sabbath. Most of us are trying hard in our own efforts to produce results. As someone said the other day, he's a mouse studying to be a rat. Others are trying to rise to a high level of mediocrity. And that's about what many of us achieve. Most people spend their lives, if they're introverted by nature, trying to be extroverts. And they think it's the extrovert, the aggressive, confident, capable individual that marks the successful kind of man. But as an actuality, this verse makes clear that both the extrovert and the introvert are missing it, because they're both looking at the same source of supply themselves. The extrovert looks at himself and he says, I've got what it takes. I've got all the training, the background, the magnetism, the personality. Let me at it. I can do it. Let me try. I've got what it takes. The introvert looks at himself and he says, oh, I can't do anything. Others are gifted, but I don't have any abilities. Let somebody else try it. I'm afraid I can't do anything. I'll make a mess of it. But what's he looking at? Himself. And in both cases, the resource is wrong. What God is endeavoring to teach us through this great sabbatical principle is that there is a resource provided for us in the work of another. And therefore, the last thing we need to note from this is that the secret of abundant living, the secret of capable life, is that we learn to enter into rest. Now, the seventh thing, therefore, about this is asking the question, why is that difficult? Hebrews 4:10 says, he that enters into God's rest ceases from his own effort. Hebrews 4:11, the very next verse says, therefore, strive to enter into rest. It's not an easy thing to do. Somehow we find it the hardest thing in the world to stop thinking that it all depends on us. And it takes some striving. It means you have to understand how fully God means what he says. It means you have to practice it to see that he will come through, as he said. But as we commit ourselves to this principle of activity, we discover we have entered into the secret of what God intended man to learn, that all the fullness of fruitfulness in his life will stem from learning how to rest in the work of another.